Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new releases, The King of Staten Island, Artemis Fowl, Da Five Bloods, You Don't Know Me, and Crossing Swords. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Doctor Who Season 12. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I wanted to hit is due to the protests and subsequent multiple instances caught on camera of police, let's just say, overstepping their subjectable use of force. Now, granted, again, this is not all the cops. These are actually, a lot of them are very isolated incidents, and in a lot of them, especially like the things where you see somebody pepper spraying somebody, it's one cop out of dozens, but of course that doesn't stop the fact that these images are being put all over social media, and they're happening at places that are protesting police brutality and the overuse of force. Not good optics on this, of course. This is one of those things that has permeated the last couple weeks of news cycles. And now, because of that, supposedly, Paramount has canceled the TV series Cops, which I didn't even know was still on, by the way. But yes, Cops has been going on for 33 years. And in a similar fashion, A&E has canceled their series Live PD, which is apparently a pretty popular show. Both of these, they're essentially the same formula. They have a camera crew that follows around a group of officers or partners on the beat. And it's them dealing with what they encounter in these situations, whether it's infractions, whether it's arrests, whether they need to defuse a situation. And I haven't watched Cops in years. I maybe watched it a little bit when I was in college. But in general, what I recall of watching Cops, what happens in this show is it's usually more about the stupid criminals than it is about the cops. It's usually something where somebody is arrested and they're drunk and they're acting like a crazy person, or they flee. I remember there's a real famous episode of a guy, I mean, he looks like a strung out meth head, you know, with full beard and hobo hair, and he's wearing like pink brawn panties and he runs away. I mean, it's stuff like that. That's what's the most entertaining part of Cops. And I'm assuming Live PD is the same thing. I've never actually watched that show at all. But both of them have been canceled. And a lot of people are saying, well, is it because there's a negative look at police right now? And sure, I think that fits with the narrative, but I think there's something more going on why these shows are being canceled. If you read between the lines of some of the stories, you got to realize you got to follow the money. And that's the way it is with any sort of business decision. And you got to remember, TV and movies, especially reality TV that's supposed to be a cash cow for a network or as a syndicated show like Cops, money is the reason these things exist. And one of the issues that happened is apparently that incident in Austin where it was a very similar to the George Floyd incident where somebody was being restrained and being tasered, or they were saying they couldn't breathe and they ended up dying. Now, of course, they didn't air that because the series kind of say, well, they do the more whimsical, stupid, silly looking stuff. But the point is those camera crews go on all of those runs and they only put the stuff that they deem worthy of broadcast on the air. There's probably tens of thousands of hours of footage that have been taken over the years that never saw the light of day. And I'm sure a lot of them are mundane stops and stuff that aren't entertaining, but I imagine that there's stuff in there that if somebody were to get their hands on that footage, it might be actionable in court. I mean, you got to remember, Cops predates body cams by decades. This has now been brought up that Live PD had footage of this incident happening. You do have liability issues. Not only do you have every single police stop, you have the chance of your production team and footage being subpoenaed for a court case of overuse of force, but you run into the risk of your people even being prosecuted as an accessory because you didn't do anything about it. Not that they have any authority over the cops, but if you don't step in while somebody's getting killed, you may face criminal charges. So I imagine that at this point, they said, look, we are not going to be the repository for all this stuff, because soon people are going to figure out, hey, this will be into the cop records, this will be into the live PD footage. And that is something that is not what the studio is going to want to be into. So I think that they're just saying, hey, we're just going to cancel the series all together. And that way that removes the entire problem. That doesn't remove the problem in the system, but it certainly removes the problem for the production companies. So I don't necessarily think that they're trying to scrub police from TV as heroes. I think that Paramount and A&E are making business decisions based on liability and legal consequences that they don't want to get all tied up into. Now, another little piece of racial news that came out this week is Gone with the Wind. It was on the HBO Max platform, and a lot of that is a Warner Brothers property. There's a lot of Warner Brothers content on there, the Harry Potter movies, the superhero movies. You've got all the Looney Tunes that are going on there. And HBO Max made a big deal in saying, hey, we're going to remove Gone with the Wind off the service and put it back on with some sort of historical context because it's of the insensitivity and the way it's showing race relations in America and sort of the glorification of slavery and the Civil War in the South in general. And of course, everybody lost their mind. And, you know, you've got liberals on one side complaining, oh, no, we need to do this more often and put context with things. And then you've got conservatives saying, how dare you censor things? That's the way. And so it got everybody up in arms. But here's the deal. Y'all got played. HBO Max announced that knowing full well that it was going to make news and they didn't have to advertise anything. You can't buy this advertising. Now everybody knows that it's a selection on HBO Max and it's going to be coming back. And then people are now going to want to go watch it when it comes back to see what historical context they put into it. Y'all got played, people. Warner Brothers in particular has been very proactive. I mean, I'm talking a decade ago, they were releasing DVDs of the old Looney Tunes and the MGM Tom and Jerry cartoons that they got their rights to. They've been releasing those and putting in disclaimers already saying this is how it was originally made and there's insensitive stuff there and there's stuff that was wrong then and it's wrong now. I've got DVDs from a decade ago that have that release information on it. So this was just HBO Max trying to get some free advertising and it worked like a charm because people just eat it up. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Bill and Ted Face the Music. This is the long-awaited sequel to Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, actually. According to the trailer, it opens in the summer, which is now, of 2020.
We were supposed to unite the world and save reality as we know it.
We've spent our whole life trying to write the song that will unite the world. Why can't we just go to the future when we have written it?
Whoa! And take it from ourselves!
But isn't that stealing?
How is that stealing if we're stealing it from ourselves, dude?
I'm a huge fan of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I also like Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, although I don't think it holds up as well. I'm still not sold on this. This looks like it might be fun, but I think they're so old in this. We don't get much sense of a story with this. This feels like a teaser for something that's going to come out in November or next summer. It doesn't feel like, hey, this is a thing that's going to be coming out in a couple weeks. The next one I want to hit really quickly is You Should Have Left, which opens on VOD next week.
What are you doing?
26 feet. 21. This room is 5 feet longer on the inside than it is on the outside.
How does that work?
It doesn't.
Anything happened yet?
Ella! Ella!
You chose this place, not me.
You sent me the link.
I absolutely did not. You sent it to me.
Do you like it here?
No. Do you?
I hate it.
This looks like an interesting film. It has Kevin Bacon and Amanda Seyfried in a house on a vacation, but the house seems to be either haunted or surreal. Or there's something strange going on. It looks like a really interesting thriller, and I'm looking forward to it. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about You Don't Know Me and Crossing Swords. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about You Don't Know Me. This documentary examines the cult status of the infamous film Showgirls.
Okay, yes, it's a failed movie.
Where are you from?
But it adds up to something.
Different places.
A type of comedy I don't think you can make on purpose, which makes it very rare and valuable.
I hadn't seen something so perfectly bad in years. It was done. Civilization had done its job.
Showgirls is also signaling to fans of Paul Verhoeven that it's like his other films.
Sexuality is part of our life, and we should not be afraid of it.
I actually saw Showgirls when it was released. My wife and I, at the time, we were boyfriend and girlfriend, and we were in college, and we drove up to Toledo, because we went to Bowling Green State University. We drove up to Toledo to go see it, just because it had such notoriety. Everyone was talking about Showgirls, good or bad, most of it bad. And I remember going to see it. It was the first time, I think, an NC-17 movie had opened in years, and it was the widest release, the highest budget NC-17 movie, and they had an usher outside the theater to make sure nobody snuck in. And my wife and I saw it, and it was awful. I stand by my take that this is an awful, awful film. Now, the entirety of the You Don't Know Me documentary is trying to convince you that it's not. They're wrong. Showgirls is a terrible movie. There's some good elements. I mean, it has fantastic production design. I mean, you get that. That's what people don't understand. Very few movies are terrible through and through. You may have great special effects or great costume design or great lighting or great cinematography. The movie Bolero actually has really nice cinematography and pretty decent costuming. It's a terrible movie, but it has elements that are good. The movie The Last Airbender, which is an absolute train wreck of a film, actually has some decent cinematography, and it has a fantastic soundtrack. But it's a turd of a movie. And here's the thing. Showgirls, they dumped $40 million into this movie in the 90s. Just like 5 years before that, the movie Hudson Hawk was considered, it was going to be a bomb because they spent $50 million on it. And no one had thought to spend that much money on a movie back then. So $40 million for an NC-17 sex romp was insane. But yes, you can have some beautiful looking sets and some gorgeous cinematography and some interesting costumes. And in fact, the dance numbers, the performance, the production numbers, much like Flashdance, which I'm not a big fan of, the production of the dance numbers are actually really good, but the movie's kind of a mess. That's at least Flashdance. I know a lot of people disagree with me on that, but Joe Esterhaus, it's his other movie. But Showgirls has some great elements to it. It's just acting, character, plot development, and story are none of them. But it's interesting to watch how people in retrospect look at it, because this is all kind of being written by people who didn't actually see it when it came out. They sort of grew up hearing about it and then ended up seeing it at a midnight movie. Well, okay, first of all, this was going to do well at midnight movies because it's so absurd and over the top. Also, it has a great connection to the drag queen community, because of course the drag shows started doing it. But I mean, if you look at Elizabeth Berkley, the opening, every single shot of the film, she has almost drag queen makeup on. I mean, her lips are overdrawn. She has big eyes. I mean, she's not quite divine level of absurdity with the makeup, but she's about as far as you could push that without getting outside of a certain realm of reality. And that makes sense. It's also very, very heavily sexual. And that is something that, of course, it works well in drag culture. It works well in a drag show. It works well with satire when they would do this stuff. And it's over the top. It's very intense. Basically, this movie is cocaine as a movie. Look, I mean, I'm not defending Showgirls, but I'm also not going to drink the Kool-Aid that it's really this masterpiece. It's an absolute mess of a movie, but made very well in certain constraints. But still, the things that would make it a good movie just aren't there. And I love bad movies, and I can get into saying, oh, I love movies that are bad. Like, I love Halloween 3. And the movie's a mess. I'll be the first one to point out all the flaws in it. And that's kind of part of the reason why I like it, because it still kind of works in this weird context. But I would never in a million years say that's as good and solid of a scary movie as the original Halloween or Psycho or John Carpenter's The Thing or something like that. You Don't Know Me is an interesting look at it because it is a group of people who really weren't around at the time trying to figure out why this movie exists. And you're like, no, it totally, in the 90s, it made total sense. Existing in that realm between Striptease and Basic Instinct, it just made sense that it was there when there was still a lot of taboo and you still had that edgy adult drama and you didn't have the internet. So porn was mildly accessible. You had to go to the weird end of town and go to the place with the windows painted black to go get your pornography. This is, you know, nowadays it's just all out there on the internet. It's like that movie Room 237 that's trying to convince you that The Shining is all these insane conspiracy theories when it clearly isn't. It's just its own movie, and it may have certain subtext to it, but it's certainly not everything that that movie throws at it. And I don't think Showgirls was everything that this movie throws at it either. But still, You Don't Know Me is an interesting look at a terrible movie. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Wow, I took a whole lot of time to talk about Showgirls. Let's quickly get through Crossing Swords. From the creator of Robot Chicken, this slice of adult animation tells the story of a knight trying to do the right thing in a flawless kingdom.
I only want to be a knight to help people in need, because the king is a terrible ruler.
We need a public execution. You go down to the dungeons for me and pick out a real all-star.
Oh my god.
Hello, little brother.
We hear you've got a new job.
The kingdom needs us. If we all stick together, we can save people.
Why would we ever do that?
Every kid wants to be a hero, but do you know how many actually go pro?
I hate my family.
This is a television series on Hulu. Each episode is about 25 minutes long. It's basically set for that half hour of programming. And like Robot Chicken, it has the look that it could be a kid's show. I mean, this one looks even more like a kid's show. This looks like kind of like a roughed-up Playmobil toy set. But, of course, they're dropping F-bombs and doing obnoxious things, and they have sex and inappropriate content and violence and stuff that you would not at all want a kid to watch. Unfortunately, that's kind of the problem. It takes a couple episodes to really get any sort of footing because it's almost like they're saying, okay, let's put this kids show out there, but then let's swear in it. At times, it almost plays like a kids show until they forget that it's a kids show and they drop an F-bomb in. It just comes out as real uneven, and I didn't get through the whole season. They're funny at times, but they're not as funny as, you know, the Rick and Morty or that Solar Opposites I talked about a couple weeks ago, or any of the Seth MacFarlane stuff that just happens to be geared towards adults. This still seems to be playing with the, are we a kid show? Tee hee hee, let's throw an F-bomb in. And that's where this one doesn't quite work, at least for the first episodes. Maybe later in the season it would work. But I have to say, from the bit that I watched for the first three or four episodes, it did not hold my interest. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the King of Staten Island and Artemis Fowl. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews, and let's talk about a couple films that were originally going to come out in theaters. Both of these were. The first one is The King of Staten Island. They decided to put this one on VOD, and I know everyone's talking about theaters are going to open up. Don't hold your breath, people. I really don't think the theaters opening up is going to be something we can rely on anytime soon. So The King of Staten Island pivoting to VOD, it makes sense. In the film, Pete Davidson stars in this would-be biopic of what his life might have been like if he didn't go into comedy.
You can't focus on Scott anymore, honey. He's 24 years old.
Don't worry, Mom. You know, your daughter got smart and went to college and abandoned us. But I'm still here. I'm going to be here forever.
Yeah.
rapper told me slow my roll.
I want to become a real tattoo artist.
Your work is mad inconsistent.
I've been dating someone for a little while now.
The first guy you date in 17 years is a fireman just like that? You don't think that's weird?
What's wrong with being a fireman?
It's fine if you don't have kids, so that way you don't crush them when you don't come home that one time.
I'm not a Pete Davidson fan. I'm not a Pete Davidson non-fan. I never watch Saturday Night Live much anymore. Occasionally, I swerve into it. Occasionally, I'll watch a sketch if it gets a lot of attention. That gives me a unique perspective of indifference to Pete Davidson, because I know he polarizes people. But I did see Big Time Adolescence on Hulu, and I talked about that a couple weeks ago. And I thought that was an okay story. What's the thing that bothers me about The King of Staten Island is there's a lot of connective tissue to Big Time Adolescence. I mean, it's certainly not the same story, and the main character is different. I mean, in the Big Time Adolescence, the main character is a teenage kid, and Pete Davidson is more of the side character. But it's as if this character from King of Staten Island just went into Big Time Adolescence on his days off. You know what I mean? It really doesn't feel like we've mined anything new. The same issues that plagued the character in Big Time Adolescence plagued the character of Pete Davidson in this movie. And I get that it's a very personal story because it's about the loss of his father in 9/11 when he was young and him having to deal without having a dad. And where he would have channeled his energies had he not gone into comedy. And I think there's a certain sweetness to that, but it also does kind of feel like we're, you know, lashing the same rock on this that we've done before, that I'm like, I've seen this before. This is nothing terribly new. Sure, it's burying his soul, but it's not burying his soul in a terribly unique or different way. And it's also directed by Judd Apatow, which I think is important to note because I have a love-hate relationship with Judd Apatow, and recently it's a lot more hate than anything. It has nothing to do with him personally. Look, I thought his first couple movies were fine. I don't want to go back and rewatch them because I have a feeling the stuff that bothers me now about his movies are going to bother me about those. I'd rather let The 40-Year-Old Virgin just sort of sit there as a fond memory than to go back and revisit it and say, ugh, I don't like that. His other films, especially the ones where he just inserts his own family in there, you saw that really bad and Funny People, and This Is 40, especially This Is 40. And I just, oh God, I just can't stand that. And I mean, aside from him putting his daughter in there as Pete Davidson's sister, she's a throwaway character. She doesn't have much to it. So, you know, even he's not putting her too high in the movie. It's not like him putting Leslie Mann as wife, inserting her into the roles. But this suffers from a lot of the same things that Judd Apatow's films do. It runs way too long. This movie's like 2 hours and 20 minutes long. It has no business being that long. You know, hour 50 tops is about what this plot can sustain. And in that sense, it drags, it struggles, it wanders, it meanders. And while I think the characters' interactions work to a degree, It's ultimately a very frustrating movie. It's not terribly satisfying, but I think it does give you what you'd want in a film like that. So I guess you're going to need to like both Pete Davidson and Judd Apatow to really appreciate this movie. I'm going to be nice. I'm going to be generous and say it kind of rocks just because I think they at least do a decent effort.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Artemis Fowl. The son of an infamous art dealer teams up with the secret world of fairies to recover an artifact and find his kidnapped father.
You've grown strong, son. And smarter than I ever imagined.
Then take me with you.
You're all I have now, Artie. There's just one very important thing I have to do.
Authorities launched a worldwide manhunt for the famous collector. He is suspected to have been behind some of the biggest robberies ever.
Dad, your family has taken something of great value from us.
This was another one that was going to be a big release. I think it was supposed to come out in May, maybe April. I can't remember when the original release date was for this, but Disney took it and said, hey, we're going to put it on our Disney Plus service. And that's probably a smart move. I do not think this would do very well in just regular old VOD. There's not a demand for it. You know, it's not like Artemis Fowl is a book series that everybody's been itching to see made into movies the way Harry Potter was or Twilight. And while it has Kenneth Branagh directing it, and he's a very good director, this feels like he's struggling a little bit with this. I had a radio colleague describe it as Harry Potter meets Men in Black. And I think that's a very realistic description of this. It's that Harry Potter, because he's this special kid, he doesn't have superpowers, but he's a genius. And I mean, I really don't understand the character. I mean, I guess they're implying the character is a super genius, and they're also implying that he has a certain level of, he's somewhere in the autism spectrum, but they really don't address that. They just present him as kind of odd. And his father studies these fairies and dwarves and elves and all that sort of thing, but they turn out to be true. And so that's where that Men in Black element comes in, because these fairies, they have technology and they live under the world. I have to say, I'm getting so tired of stories where you have this super advanced culture living in hiding, going, well, we can't let the normal humans see us. I'm like, really? Really? We're that much danger to you? You know, like the vampires in Twilight or the magical world in Harry Potter. I mean, who cares what the muggles think? Even if you don't outnumber them, you certainly outpower them with magic and all. So I don't know. I get tired of them always having to live in hiding. The character of Artemis Fowl is kind of all over the map. And part of it is because even though this takes place in the normal world, they just cram so much world building into it. And like that, just in the first 10 minutes, you don't get a chance to breathe. And it just keeps throwing stuff at you that is so hard to catch up on. When really, I think there might have been a, you know, easier way of doing it. You could distill this out, or you just drop you into the world and realize that this is the way it is. It feels like this should have had an entire movie of an origin story so that you could then tell this story. And it's kind of what it feels like, because it just hits the ground running so fast. And as a result, you do not get a good characterization of Artemis at all in the movie. His relationship with the other people in the film, or even his relationship with his father. It has some neat elements to it. I mean, it has some cool action but it reminds me a lot of, oh gosh, you know, something like John Carter, where it's this big spectacle, but just kind of misses the mark almost every single time, but it's still a watchable movie. And I think dropping it onto Disney Plus is a smart idea, because it certainly feels like they want to make a TV series out of this. And if it can perform well enough on Disney Plus, maybe they can justify doing a series, because Disney Plus is going to have to flesh out its series. Just having Star Wars and Marvel, that held you for about 6 months, but I'm already starting to hear from other people saying, well, there's nothing new on Disney Plus. You know, you had The Mandalorian, and a lot of people stuck around for that, but you know, you got to be dropping new content all the time, and it can't just be, hey, these are these classic movies that you may already have on DVD and Blu-ray. So I think Disney is going to really have to start producing new content that appeals to a wider family audience. And I think an Artemis Fowl series might help if they can solve some of the clunkiness of this movie. So still, I mean, Artemis Fowl, it's harmless, but it's also not anything that's going to be groundbreaking. I'm going to be nice. If I gave King of Staten Island the kind of rocks, I got to give Artemis Fowl the kind of rocks as well.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Five Bloods and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Doctor Who Season 12.
Picket lines, sister, and picket signs, sister. Don't punish me, sister, with brutality, sister. Talk to me, so you can see, what's going on, what's going on.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film. And this is a new movie on Netflix. This is Spike Lee's film, The Five Bloods. Four Vietnam vets return to the country to find the remains of a fellow soldier as well as a buried treasure.
Gentlemen, welcome back to Vietnam.
Hello, sir.
Look what I found.
Anyway,
dirty man in all his glory.
Who was that guy?
That brother was the best soldier that ever lived.
Hey, I have no place to stay.
Hey, we
We bury it. Pay to own, we come back and collect.
The love has flown away.
This was always going to be a Netflix release, but they were going to try and put it in limited release in theaters. It's pretty early still for them to be really pushing the in-theater/Netflix release. They waited until like fall, you know, award season for stuff like Marriage Story and The Irishman last year. And I have to say, this is a bold step forward for Netflix, and I hope it sticks around, because before anything about this film, Delroy Lindo deserves an Oscar for this movie. He is fantastic in it. Delroy Lindo bears his soul in this movie. He has the most complex character in the film, and he moves through all the iteration and facets of that character brilliantly. So I hope that people remember his performance for this movie 6 months plus from now as award season gets into full swing. With that said, let's talk about the film itself. You know, it's a Spike Lee joint. Spike Lee has had an interesting career. His earlier films have a lot of energy, and it shows he's got a real interesting style. He uses his style in this movie more than I've seen him do lately. You can really see his style, especially in stuff like School Days and Do the Right Thing. You know, even stuff like Mo Better Blues and Malcolm X. When he did Malcolm X, he went from sort of like being, I mean, when he did, and I talked about this a little bit last week when I was talking about Do the Right Thing. He was just, when he started out, he was the angry young black man, and he had something to say, and he was not subtle at all in anything he did. When he did Malcolm X, which can be a polarizing movie, and if you can get past some of the overt politics that can be a little pushy, it's a brilliant movie, and it really shows growth for Spike Lee as a director, because he handles this massive story that goes on for 3+ hours. So he grew during that period, and then he was juggling around with other things, you know, trying different things, and he did good and bad, and he's done some good and bad stuff over the year. He did a war film, which really wasn't very good. I don't even remember the name of it. He did this small little, almost dog meat production, a remake of Ganja and Hess called The Sweet Blood of Jesus. And that thing was a real mess. But he's also kind of had a comeback recently. I mean, Black Klansman was an amazing movie, extremely well done. And part of the reason it was so good was because it didn't present a typical Spike Lee movie. And I will say this about The Five Bloods. This is not a typical Spike Lee movie. This has a lot of depth. This has a lot of character. This is unconventional, and it's not anything that you would expect it to be. It tackles a lot. Sometimes, especially early in his career, you would be very one note. Do the Right Thing, while it had different facets to it, Do the Right Thing's pretty one note. But this movie, it deals with race relations in Vietnam, the fact that like 30-some% of the soldiers were black, but they only were 11% of the population, the treatment of the American soldier, the treatment of the black American soldier, the treatment of the black GIs by the Vietnamese versus the white GIs. In the trailer, you didn't hear it in this cut, but in the trailer and in the movie, they play bits from Hanoi Hannah. And it shows where that propaganda was used to really reel in, I mean, played with their minds, because their government was not treating them as well as the white soldiers sometimes. And I mean, I think that this movie takes that in historical context, and it shows how it can have an effect on people, especially when at home you're having the protests and you're having the Black Power movement and all that stuff boiling over in the United States. At the same time, this movie deals with the relations with Vietnam, not just back then, but more importantly now. And while everyone thinks, oh, it's just a vacation spot now, you know, there are still people that carry baggage, and there are still people that carry grudges, and there are still people that were harmed irrevocably in the Vietnam War that are still struggling. The trauma that the Vietnamese are feeling, and the trauma that the soldiers are feeling, in particular Delroy Lindo, his character, massively saddled with PTSD and not treated at all. and not wanting to get treated. I mean, this is a lot of stuff that's going on. It deals with the guilt, and there's a lot to it. And it doesn't fit in this standard like three act structure. You it's really hard to tell where the story arc's going because it kind of leaps about three or four times. But it makes it more interesting because I never felt like it got pedantic. I really did enjoy this movie because of the examination that Spike Lee does with so many different topics and so much to deconstruct. And sometimes you're just saying, I don't know what to do with this, but here's something. And that's bold for Spike Lee to do because he always seems to have an answer in, like, especially his earlier movies. So I'm going to have to say The Five Bloods is a really fascinating film. It takes a while. It's a 2.5-hour movie. You got to sit down and watch it. But it's a good flick, and I got to say, it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the show with the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Doctor Who Season 12. The Doctor travels through time and space to fight allies and robots, only to discover several old enemies in the mix.
The name's Doctor. The Doctor.
The security of this entire planet is at stake. Can we rely upon you?
I'm not where I wanted to be, but I can work with this. I don't suppose you've seen anything weird around here.
You believe this is alien?
What's the plan? You trust me, don't you?
Have I got to answer that?
Where are we? Paris, 1943? Oh no. Something's coming for me.
This is the second season with Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor, the first female Doctor. And we're still trying to figure her footing. I think, for the most part, Jodie Whittaker is where she needs to be on this franchise. I think she does a good job. A lot of it hinges on your companions, and she's got a great group of companions. And they mine the companions for some stories, but not all of them, which is good, because sometimes if you spend too much time with the companion, the Doctor becomes superfluous, and you really want a story about the Doctor. That's what makes it interesting and sexy. But they do pull out some old enemies. They do pull out some old characters that probably are getting to the point where you're like, okay, we probably should let these characters disappear. Or they're really sort of grinding the gears to try and bring back some of these characters. I want to see the new bad guys. I want to see the equivalent of the Weeping Angels from the David Tennant years. I want to see the equivalent of the Silence from the Matt Smith years. These characters that you're not used to. And if you're going to bring back an enemy, you know, bring back somebody like the Centaurans. You know, they did that throughout the new rebooted Doctor Who, because the Centaurans just had a real bit part in an early episode, maybe another episode. There was only like one or two series that they had in the old days. You don't have to just keep rehashing the same bad guys over and over and over again. I mean, sure, bring back the Daleks now and then. I like them, but this season, overall, I think it's better than season 12. I think that Jodie Whittaker certainly found her stride, and the companions all work. I want a little bit more whimsy from the stories, and I see that they did some more historic elements, like they run into Nikola Tesla in one episode. But I want to see a little bit, you know, more punch to that. I want to see a little bit more, at least a little more hope to it, and a little bit more brightness. It's starting to get a little heavy and drab. So I'm looking forward to the 13th season. I like Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor. I think she's good. I hope she sticks with it for a while. Overall, I'm going to have to say that this season kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week is The Hunt, that infamous movie that got crushed by the COVID virus. Also, We Summon the Darkness, a neat little satanic panic kind of movie. Eureka, the complete series. And a couple classics, including Kiss the Blood Off My Hands with Joan Fontaine and Burt Lancaster, as well as Victor and Victoria, which is the original movie that Blake Edwards' Victor Victoria was based on. And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about the Kevin Bacon movie You Should Have Left, plus Baby Teeth and Blood Machines on Shudder. And until then, have a fat time at the movies. Or at home.